Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adam Horowitz, co-editor of MondoWeiss.net, an online forum on Middle East issues, who examines the recent failure of U.S.-brokered Middle East peace talks. Jamie Raskin, a professor of constitutional law and a Maryland state senator, who assesses the recent Supreme Court ruling that upheld a Michigan constitutional amendment which banned the use of affirmative action in the state's public universities. And Diane Ross Tierney of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, who discusses the botched April 29th execution of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma and the ongoing national campaign to outlaw capital punishment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
President Barack Obama put a hard edge on his Asia pivot with the recent signing of a 10-year military cooperation agreement with the Philippines. The deal will deploy U.S. troops and aircraft to the Philippines at levels not seen for 20 years when America's Subic Bay Naval Base and Clark Airfield were shut down. The agreement puts U.S. forces in the middle of the South China Sea, an area where several islands and sea lanes are contested by China and its neighbors in the Asia-Pacific, including Vietnam, the Philippines, and Malaysia. China also has increasingly tense relations with Japan over disputed islands in the East China Sea. According to Businessweek, China will be modernizing its fleet of destroyers and frigates over the next decade. Although China recently announced plans to increase its military budget by over 12%, the nation's budget is less than a quarter of the Pentagon's. Desmond Dessa is the second anti-pollution activist from Durban, South Africa, to win the Goldman Environmental Prize, often dubbed the Green Nobel Prize. Dessa, co-founder of the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, led an innovative campaign to shut down an industrial toxic landfill in 2011. For 20 years, South Durban residents endured fumes from paint thinners, solvents, and pesticides. South Durban, a community of 300,000 people, is known as South Africa's Cancer Alley. The community has 300 industrial plants surrounded by tens of thousands of poor and disenfranchised residents, many of whom were forcibly relocated there during the apartheid era. The community has the highest cancer and asthma rate in sub-Saharan Africa. A former chemical worker and union official, Dessa developed a smell chart to help community residents identify which toxic chemicals they were exposed to. His Community Environmental Alliance also trained local residents how to measure toxic exposure and to take polluters to court. For his activism, Dessa has paid a heavy price. After his home was firebombed and he suffered severe burns and ongoing threats against his life, Dessa was forced to live apart from his family. The 80-year-old weekly, Newsweek, published what was supposed to be its final print edition at the end of 2012. However, the magazine, which had gone to an all-digital format, reappeared on newsstands on March 7th, featuring an exposé of the alleged founder of Bitcoin, the digital currency. Newsweek returned to print after it was sold in August 2013 to the International Business Times, a popular news website with deep ties to a Christian sect run by Korean David Jang, who has legions of followers in what is known as the community. IBT founders Etienne Uzak and Jonathan Davis have deep ties to Jang and his multiple ministries, media outlets, and Olivet University, a small Bible college founded by Jang in 2004. An investigation by Mother Jones magazine found that Olivet's international students attending the school in the U.S. often work long hours for IBT and other Jang-run publications, with some earning less than the minimum wage. David Jang worked his way up in the hierarchy of Reverend Sun Myung-moon's Unification Church in the 1980s, before breaking away to create his own religious ministries and enterprises. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
After 9 months of shuttle diplomacy and more than 100 closed-door meetings around the world, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's effort to broker a peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians ended in failure. With the end of the Obama administration's latest effort to get both sides to sign on to a proposed two-state solution, each side blamed the other for the lack of progress. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pulled out of the talks shortly after Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, signed an April 23rd agreement with the militant Hamas faction that controls Gaza. The two rivals committed to forming a new unity government in 5 weeks and holding a presidential election in 7 months. Israel, the U.S., and European Union have designated Hamas a terrorist organization. For their part, the Palestinians said the failure of the talks can be traced to Israel's reneging on its promised release of a final group of 26 long-serving Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. They also point out that during the 9 months of talks, Israel initiated plans to build 13,851 housing units on contested land in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, 4 times the number than in previous years. Your reporter spoke with Adam Horowitz, co-editor of Mondeweiss.net, an online forum on Middle East issues. Here he examines the reasons for the failure of this latest round of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks and summarizes some of the points made in his recent article titled, 5 Reasons the Breakdown of Peace Talks is a Good Thing.
Of course, you know, everybody wants a resolution to the conflict, and it would be understandable if people saw this failure as a really dispiriting turn of events. I wrote this piece for several reasons why it shouldn't be viewed that way. And really, the one takeaway, and there's several points, but the one takeaway is just simply that no deal is better than a bad deal. And although this framework for negotiations was never publicly released, there were leaks that were coming from the negotiating team, and all signs were that this framework would be a really bad deal for the Palestinians. I mean, there are these core issues that the Palestinians bring to the table in every version of the peace talks, and this framework was basically going to be asking them to put those aside. And those issues include having a capital in East Jerusalem, allowing for the return of Palestinian refugees to their homes and lands, while at the same time, this framework also really incorporated all of Israel's core issues. One of the big ones that was leaked, and again, we don't know what the actual details were because it was never released, but all these leaks seem to indicate that the United States was going to push for continued Israeli military presence in the Jordan Valley. So if you can imagine what the map would look like with Israel controlling the territory that it is now internationally recognized as Israel, plus the Jordan Valley on the border with Jordan, what that really ends up leaving are basically just these islands of Palestinian control in the West Bank. Whether Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian negotiating team would have agreed to that, we don't know. There's certainly indications that they wouldn't because that framework deal was never announced, but this would not have been a workable deal. Regardless if they agreed to it, it would not have been a workable deal in terms of ending the conflict, which should be seen as somewhat different from a workable deal to keep negotiations going or to keep the peace process going.
As you wrote, Adam, the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement around the world, has worried Israeli officials, although it doesn't have a lot of visibility here in the United States in our media. It does trouble the Israelis in terms of the long run. Tell us how you think the BDS movement could be effective in moving the Israeli government in the future to agree to some planks of a peace agreement that they have not been in agreement with in the past.
I mean, it's interesting because today in the Boston Globe, there was an interesting op-ed by Andrew Bacevich, who is no lefty by any account, and he was writing his sort of postmortem of the peace process. And basically, part of his analysis is, you know, Israel is an incredibly strong country by almost any estimation, militarily, economically, and they're basically being asked to give up something for, in their view, almost nothing. They have all the cards right now. What do they have to gain by making peace with the Palestinians? And part of his point is that the U.S. is in a role where they could make it worth Israel's while to make peace. they could start pulling back U.S. aid. They can start pulling back diplomatic support. But at this point, the U.S. has shown no indication to do that. So really, Israel has very little to gain by making peace. And that's where the BDS movement comes in, because they are the one player here that is trying to say there's a price to pay for the status quo. The BDS movement started in 2005. It's a really new movement. It's a completely grassroots movement, but it's already had really an amazing success record given that amount of time. It is true what you said, that it is relatively more grassroots in the United States, but in Europe, it's actually much more advanced. And there was one comment that I quoted in that piece by Tippi Livni, who is the Israeli justice minister, who was quoted in the Israeli press as saying, maintaining the peace process is essential to keep the European Union from deepening a boycott of Israeli settlements. That if it is shown that the peace process is going nowhere or is a sham, then these floodgates will really open of boycotts and sanctions against Israel. Now, one thing that's different in Europe and in the United States is that Israeli settlements produce fruits and vegetables that are exported to Europe. There's been a movement in recent years to have those clearly marked so that consumers will know whether they're buying something that's grown in the settlement. And there's now a growing movement in the EU to stop the import of settlement produce altogether. You know, with each moment where Israel thumbs its nose at the international community, the BDS movement only grows exponentially as more and more people who are, you know, legitimately concerned about ending this conflict see no other possibility. They don't see the U.S. government as being willing to take meaningful action. They're not seeing any of the other international organizations doing that, and so it's left to civil society. It might not be able to change the balance of forces by itself, but it is able to even the playing field some and begin a process of building political power, which I think ultimately is the goal.
That was Adam Horowitz, co-editor of MondoWeiss.net, an online forum on Middle East issues. For more analysis and commentary on the decades-long conflict between Israel and Palestine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 22nd, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a Michigan constitutional amendment that bans affirmative action in admissions to the state's public universities. The 6-2 ruling effectively endorsed similar measures in 7 other states and may encourage additional states to pass new laws banning consideration of race in admissions policy. This is the 3rd affirmative action case from the state of Michigan to be decided by the Supreme Court. In 2003, the court struck down a plan from the University of Michigan Undergraduate College in which a point system gave specific weight to minority applicants. But the court upheld the University of Michigan Law School's admission policy because it was more generalized. Then conservatives in Michigan pushed through an amendment to the state constitution forbidding any consideration of race in the admissions process. That referendum question was approved in 2006 with 58% of the vote. But the amendment was challenged by a coalition of student and minority rights groups who won their case at the appellate level but lost in this recent Supreme Court ruling. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Jamie Raskin, a professor of constitutional law at American University, a Maryland state senator, and a senior fellow with the group People for the American Way. Here he talks about the significance of this latest high court ruling and suggests alternative methods of rectifying historic discrimination.
Essentially what the court has done is to say that affirmative action and the use of race in admissions or in hiring can be forbidden by a state by virtue of state constitutional amendment or even just by virtue of state law. What the court has said basically is that if a state wants to use affirmative action within the strict limits it has imposed in the past, it can do so. But if it wants to forbid the use of affirmative action, it can forbid it too.
I've read that the percentages of Black and Latino students, at least in the more prestigious universities, has dropped significantly since some of these other affirmative action restrictions have been put in place. So these cases have a real-world impact.
The withdrawal of affirmative action has meant that the numbers of minority students at the most selective universities and colleges has plummeted. On the other hand, in Texas, after their racial affirmative action plan was struck down, they moved to a different plan which guaranteed admission to the University of Texas and other state universities and colleges to the top 5% of the graduating class in each high school all over the state. So that guaranteed a kind of geographic distribution that allowed for diversity. So there are other mechanisms that states are starting to put in place to deal with both the state law and their hostile affirmative action and to the Supreme Court decision.
Jamie Raskin, over the course of all the decisions on affirmative action over the decades, how far-reaching is this one, do you think?
Most of the main damage had already been done. I mean, there's really not much left of affirmative action. The court permits generally state universities and colleges to have generalized kinds of targets, but it can never make a difference in a particular case, and it can't be quantified, and you can't set aside certain numbers. There is a movement to try to get colleges and universities to engage in affirmative action based on economic disadvantage, which obviously will help to lift up a lot of racial and ethnic minorities, as well as poor and working class white people. You know, in general, I think that progressive movements are focused now on questions of student debt and how to make college more affordable for everybody. And in some sense, these questions may be more congruent with what the original civil rights movement was interested in, which was dramatic changes in people's access to higher education and to jobs. So there may be a way in which the right-wing assault on affirmative action, which is simply ferocious and unremitting, could lead us to go back to the demand for universal rights and benefits and entitlements, you know, in the educational field. You know, in Europe today, everybody essentially has the right to a college education. You know, once you get in, it's tough, you've got to work hard and so on, but everybody has a right to go. And that would be something that could be put on the table today. You know, just like universal health care could be put on the table today. So instead of beginning with the assumption of scarcity and dividing up, you know, a scarce resource according to some, you know, racial or ethnic criterion, instead start with the assumption that everybody should have access to health care, everybody should have access to college education if that's something that they want to do. Because, you know, what we have today is a Supreme Court that is very hostile to the Reconstruction Amendment, specifically the 14th Amendment and Equal Protection, which was not just about the formal treatment of people as equals, but it was about actually changing a profoundly racist society and trying to redistribute wealth, power, and social opportunities to people who had been marginalized and oppressed by law and by social convention for centuries.
There's a certain stigma for people of color getting admitted to institutions of higher education through affirmative action, the assumption being they wouldn't have gotten in otherwise. Do you think that race-based affirmative action was never the best way to go?
You know, if you go back and look at the politics of the civil rights movement in the 60s and the writings of civil rights leaders, there was very little discussion of affirmative action. There was a lot of discussion about dismantling structures of discrimination and exclusion and then redistributing opportunities and wealth and power to bring everybody in. So it was much more concerned with a vision of real democratization rather than, you know, adding a few people here and adding a few people there. So, you know, I like much better the image of the civil rights movement of creating movements to change the nature of society rather than assuming somehow the superiority or the virtue of particular institutions that were racist and exclusionary and elitist and reactionary for centuries and just trying to get a few people into those institutions. And I just think that the civil rights movement would be better off today, or progressive movements generally, fighting for universal rights and entitlements for everybody.
That was Maryland State Senator Jamie Raskin, a professor of constitutional law at American University and a senior fellow with the group People for the American Way. For more perspectives on affirmative action in higher education, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On the evening of April 29th, the scheduled execution of two death row inmates got underway in Oklahoma. Prison officials administered a lethal injection to inmate Clayton Lockett, who was convicted of first-degree murder for the 1999 shooting of 19-year-old Stephanie Neiman, who his accomplice buried alive. Witnesses reported that Lockett gasped for air and writhed on the execution gurney shortly after the lethal drugs were injected. Prison authorities later explained that due to a collapsed vein, the needle was inserted into Locke's groin area instead of the arm after prison officials used a taser gun to restrain him. Just over 7 minutes after the execution protocol had begun, Lockett was pronounced dead of a heart attack. The scheduled second execution of Charles Warner that evening was postponed by 14 days. An important element in the status of American capital punishment today is the shortage of lethal drugs used by Oklahoma and other states to execute prisoners. The only U.S. manufacturer of sodium thiopental, a key ingredient of lethal injections, stopped making the drug in 2011. But when death penalty states attempted to purchase the drug from European manufacturers, the supply was shut down due to the European Union's commitment to abolish the death penalty around the world. Now states are experimenting with different combinations of lethal drugs, with some turning to compounding pharmacies, which are subject to little oversight by the federal government. Your reporter spoke with Diane Ross Tierney, executive director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, who discusses the circumstances surrounding the botched execution of Clayton Lockett and the ongoing national campaign to abolish capital punishment.
In many ways, Mr. Lockett's execution was sort of botched from the beginning. There was plenty of information to foreshadow what was going to happen. And the reason for that was the incredible secrecy that the state wanted to put around the efforts there. In Oklahoma, they were experimenting with drug protocols and some drug combinations that nobody knew what they were, where they were from, or how they were going to interact. And the lawyers in that case had actually been pleading with the state to come forth with that information so that there could be a proper oversight and some of these challenges, some of these concerns could have been addressed. And so what we had in Oklahoma was a situation where the system actually just broke down. The state of Oklahoma insisted on going forward with this execution under a shroud of secrecy. When the defendants in that case went to the courts to ask for more transparency, the state Supreme Courts were back and forth in a tussle among themselves about who was going to deal with this case. Finally, the state Supreme Court did deal with the case. They did grant a stay of execution on this question of whether there could be this kind of secrecy going into the execution. But then the legislature got into the act, and they threatened to impeach the five justices that voted for a stay in the case. The governor of the state got involved and issued an executive order saying that she was going to force the executions no matter what the Supreme Court said. And so, not surprisingly, the Supreme Court succumbed to that pressure and allowed the executions to go forward. And so you had from the very beginning a prescription for the very disaster that we saw. And then since then, I think that the death penalty in general and the system of justice in Oklahoma has come under, you know, close scrutiny. And I want to emphasize what we saw in terms of the botched execution was sort of emblematic of the botched system that we have all along from beginning to end. And so that's why we have the controversy that we have here today.
Diane, apart from the conditions under which the state is now taking lives of death row inmates, tell us a bit about the important issue of racial bias in our judicial system across the country, where you see a disproportionate number of African Americans and Hispanics being convicted of capital crimes and then being sentenced to death, very different numbers than the white majority.
As you point out, the system has historically been used more frequently when the victim is white. Currently, if you look at the number of people who have been executed since 1976, 77% of the crimes for which people have been executed were crimes committed against white victims. And that's even though people of color account for about 50% of all homicide victims, and that's been consistent. And then when you look at the disproportionate number, African Americans are disproportionately represented on death row. And we see this at the state level, we see it at the federal level, and it's consistent. There have been a number of surveys over the 30 years that consistently, state after state, show that your odds of getting a death sentence are you know, more than double, at least in some places, and others four times as likely to get the death penalty if your victim is white. And in some particular places, the race of the defendant serves as what they call in the legal jargon as an aggravating factor. That means if you are a person of color and you commit a crime, particularly against a white victim, that skyrockets your chance of getting a death sentence. And that's when you control for all the kinds of things that would explain why some people get the death sentence and some others. Prior criminal offense, treatment of the victim. When you control for all the things that reasonably distinguish cases, race comes up over and over again. And so, again, can we have a death penalty system that operates consistent with our other values? Apparently not. And the fact that we continue to allow the death penalty to proceed when it's so racially skewed, again, undermines our commitment to the things that we all agree ought to be part of our national character and our value.
Diane, tell us a bit about the state-by-state fight to abolish the death penalty, the successes you've had, and the challenges ahead.
This discussion is happening in a context where support for the death penalty is at an all-time low. According to Pew reports, Gallup polls, Pew reports cites that public support for the death penalty is down to around 55%. At the same time, we're also seeing an increase in the number of people who are opposed to the death penalty. The Pew poll again found 37% of the public as being opposed to the death penalty, and we think that translates into about 90 million people. 90 million people hold the view that it's time for the death penalty to end. And so part of what we're doing here is mobilizing and energizing and connecting that force of the public to get engaged in the death penalty. And now is the best time. We couldn't find a better time, and we couldn't find a better opportunity, because we now have the momentum. We've seen states like Connecticut, Illinois, Maryland just last year, New Mexico, New Jersey, New York. All of these states have examined the death penalty carefully and decided it's time to get rid of it. It's not working. It's not fair. It's not consistent with our other values.
That was Diane Russ Tierney, Executive Director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Find more analysis and commentary on the botched execution of Clayton Lockett and groups campaigning to end capital punishment in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.